This is Your Called Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. Now we are going to discuss media coverage of Trump's ongoing attacks on LGBTQ plus communities. In a piece for The Appeal, our next guest, Adam Rhodes, writes that the breakneck speed at which the Trump administration has targeted trans people shows no sign of slowing down, even as his earliest anti-trans executive orders face tremendous legal battles and setbacks as courts issue rulings blocking them across the nation. Emboldened by an administration that increasingly seeks to remove trans people from public life, conservative legislators across the country are escalating attacks on trans people with renewed fervor, in some cases using the criminal legal system as an anti-trans cudgel. Adam Rhodes is a first-generation Cuban-American journalist whose work primarily focuses on queer people and the criminal legal system. Adam is also a training director at Investigative Reporters and Editors. Adam was most recently a staff writer and social justice reporter at the Chicago Reader, and they have been published in outlets including BuzzFeed News and the Washington Post. Hi, Adam. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So first off, reading your story, I was thinking back about the anti-trans ads we saw from the Republican Party in the lead up to the election. They spent $215 million on those ads. How do you think major media outlets are covering the Trump administration's ongoing war on LGBTQ people? And just media in general, how have they been covering trans people and trans rights?
You know, it is certainly not coverage that is created equally. I think there are some outlets who are doing, you know, fantastic work. And it's not just like LGBTQ plus serving outlets. It's, you know, local newspapers across the country, radio stations, TV stations, what have you, are doing great work, certainly. But there is absolutely a pattern of really harmful and in many cases, outright just false coverage about trans people, our experiences in healthcare and sports and education, what have you. So it is really a mixed bag in terms of the quality of coverage that we're seeing, unfortunately.
You know, and I have to ask this because this is such a good point about sports. That's what gets so much attention is should trans women especially be able to play on women's sports teams. What are your thoughts about how that is covered and how do you think it should be covered?
You know, I think there are several different things. Number one, I think as we've seen in congressional testimony, the amount of NCAA trans athletes can be counted on two hands. It is such a insignificant matter. I'm not even going to call it a problem because it's not a problem. It's just an insignificant thing that conservative and Republican legislators are really glomming onto as we face, you know, historic economic crises in this country. And I just frankly think it is a tremendous distraction. It's targeting a small group of vulnerable people for the sake of, you know, fabricating this national scandal. And that's just, you know, college athletes. Let's talk about, you know, elementary school students and high school students who all they want to do is, you know, run track with their friends or, you know, play tennis. You know, the point of sports is not to win. It's not to be the best. It is, you know, to compete and to build community and be a team with your fellow athletes. And I think, you know, folks are robbing children of that. And, you know, the media has certainly had a hand to play in that. There are certainly some news organizations who have fanned the flames of this fabricated crisis. But then there are other news organizations who have, I think, really done a great job at talking to trans athletes, people on the ground, about what this issue really is.
And we often talk about the fact that words have consequences, the fact that this gets so much attention has consequences. GLAAD announced the findings of its third annual Alert Desk report. And they found that between May of last year and May of this year, they tracked 932 anti-LGBTQ incidents in 49 states and D.C. This is about 2.5 incidents every day.
Yeah, that's stunning. Wow.
So that's it's just important to, you know, bring that to the table because people are dealing with the ramifications of these issues getting so much attention.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it has really, really tremendous impact on people's quality of life. It's not just like, whether kids can play sports, it's whether families feel safe in their communities, whether people have had to leave the state, the country, to provide even basic medical care, basic, livelihood for their families.
So, what do you think deserves more attention right now? Because so much is happening and it's hard to keep up. You, in your piece in the appeal, you write that the Trump administration has issued orders and supported legislation seeking to cut access to gender-affirming care or outright ban it in some cases, roll back the rights of incarcerated trans people, and block trans people from updating ID documents to reflect who they are. And this is just, it's only June.
Yeah, I think it's important to say that, the far-reaching kind of scope of this and the fact that things are happening at such a breakneck speed is very intentional. It's hard to for people who are advocating, supporting, and fighting legal battles for trans people to handle all of this at once. So I think, from my perspective and talking to my sources and just from what I've seen, I think it's, very much an intentional effort to kind of overwhelm these communities and these vulnerable people so that it's hard to, handle everything or tackle everything or address everything. But like you said, it's only June and it is really, for lack of a better phrase, just shocking and, gobsmacking to see just like I wrote, like the breakneck pace with which the Trump administration is targeting trans people. I think, before the actual inauguration, I was prepping a lot of work that was kind of forward-looking about like what could possibly happen in the coming, 4 years, coming months or whatever. And it was a piece about, how Trump could possibly impact incarcerated trans people. And less than a month in office, that entire article basically had to be rewritten because he put out a massive order that changed the landscape of how trans folks are incarcerated in the federal system. And so it's really just a tsunami for, to put it into a metaphor of anti-trans action that folks are having to contend with both on a personal level, as trans folks, but on a professional level as like, trans advocates or, people fighting these orders.
And at the federal level, why do you think this administration is cracking down so hard and moving so swiftly, specifically on trans issues?
I think it is a manufactured crisis that is certainly designed to distract from like the actual problems facing people in this country, unemployment, rising costs, lack of adequate health care, things like that. And I think, it's just a decades-long continuation of Republican Party's attacks on LGBTQ plus people. I think a lot of trans people for are, obviously the most significant target of the Trump administration and Republicans. But Republicans all across the country are trying to roll back basic civil liberties protections for LGBTQ plus people broadly. How many states have like asked the Supreme Court to overturn Obergefell? Rights that we, for a long time thought were kind of settled and done, and now they're coming back to the fore, because Republicans have been able to make inroads, by using trans people as, that boogeyman that they've kind of turned trans people into.
And we're still waiting for a Supreme Court decision. I'm just reading a piece right now from Lil Kalish at HuffPost. This Supreme Court decision might end up displacing families for good. Future access to gender-affirming care for trans youth is in the hands of the Supreme Court, and the stakes couldn't be higher. So this decision is expected to come down any day now.
And like Lil says, it has life-changing impacts for people. Like it's really hard to underscore just how important this is for folks.
And this is important because I think things are moving so fast. There's such a focus on the policies, on Trump, what they say, and not as much focus on how lives are actually affected on the ground. NPR has had some really powerful pieces about families who've had to move across the country in some cases. I mean, families are being forced to leave their homes to ensure that their children receive the care that they need and deserve. Can you talk more about that?
It just puts both, you know, trans parents and then cisgender parents of trans kids in such an impossible position that you essentially have to decide if you have the means to, you know, spend thousands, tens of thousands of dollars potentially, literally uproot every aspect of life, you know, leaving friends, leaving potential family, leaving jobs, to seek out what is just basic medical care for your child. You know, this is medical care that, you know, has been approved and affirmed by every major medical association. It has, I think the most recent statistics are less than 1% regret rate among the people who get gender affirming care, and then, you know, eventually surgeries if that is even obtained by the folks. But yeah, you know, this puts people in such a horrible, horrible position. You know, again, if they have the means, but if they don't have the means, it traps people, oftentimes young trans kids in states that don't support them, that they'll have to detransition. They're removed from, you know, treatment plans that may have been on for years. And we know the tremendous consequences, both physical and emotional, that this has for folks.
In your piece, you report that for parents seeking out-of-state medical care or for their trans children, organizations like Elevated Access offer free private travel for those seeking care. Are you finding that, I mean, so many people are just having such a hard time financially right now, but is the trans safety net growing in some cases?
You know, that's hard to say. I think it always kind of has been there. But I think it is, I think, being utilized a lot more. Frankly, this is an issue that trans people are not unaccustomed to. Trans people have had to think creatively about how to get care, not just hormones, but like, you know, gender affirming care in any capacity for decades. You know, it's only recently that this care has kind of hit the mainstream. So I think, unfortunately, what is really happening is trans people in trans healthcare is going kind of back into the, you know, for lack of a better phrase, like the dark ages where folks don't go to their doctors for healthcare, but are forced to seek it out elsewhere, with obviously da sometimes dangerous consequences.
We're speaking with Adam Rhodes, a first-generation Cuban-American journalist whose work primarily focuses on queer people and the criminal legal system. We're talking about a piece he wrote for The Appeal called Trump's War on Trans People, a Legal Survival Guide. You also write that conservative legislators at the state level have been emboldened by the Trump administration. A bill proposed by Texas Republican State Representative Tom Oliverson in early March would make, quote, gender identity fraud, a state jail felony, threatening jail time for those who identify as trans on government and employment-related documents. The bill, which died in committee, follows a bill proposed by his colleague that would ban gender-affirming care for adults in the state. And you report that as it stands now, six states, including Florida, Oklahoma, and North Dakota, have criminal penalties for providing gender-affirming care. Can you tell us how that plays out on the ground?
You know, I admittedly haven't really, really closely followed cases where it's happened, but I think the biggest impact of these bills is not necessarily the criminal prosecutions. While that is certainly significant, I just haven't seen a ton of journalism about those prosecutions. But what these bills do have is a chilling effect. I think, you know, even if there is a highly, or if it's highly unlikely that a state will actually prosecute these charges, the fear of these charges is enough to stop people from providing care. It's enough to stop doctors from serving folks. And quite frankly, even these bills have had, you know, a chilling effect in other states. We saw hospitals in New York City say that they were going to stop or, you know, cancel, or cancel appointments for people accessing gender-affirming care. So I think we're still kind of watching how this plays out because, again, it's in such like a small handful of states. But nationally, the threat of these criminal penalties has really, I think, put a chilling effect on a lot of folks' ability to obtain care.
You write that legal advocates across the board say even amid the escalating challenges trans people and their loved ones face, as insurmountable as they may feel, there are still avenues for safety, for solidarity, and for survival. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, I think, To be frank, no matter what the Trump administration does, is there's always going to be queer and trans people. We will exist and have existed for centuries. And so the solidarity, the safety, and the security that I feel comes from my community. It comes from not just, thinking about like how to navigate this oftentimes insurmountable kind of action by the government, but just sitting with my queer and trans friends and just not letting everything that we're seeing stop us from existing happily, publicly, proudly. If anything, I think it has emboldened a lot of us. And that obviously comes with a lot of privilege and the ability to kind of stand in that queerness. But I think that's important, that no matter what happens, we have each other, we have community, and relying on community has gotten us to the point that we're at now, and it will continue and help us through what we're seeing.
You also train journalists. What are you hearing from LGBTQ colleagues? Because you have to report on these issues, they're also so personal.
That is a kind of perennial challenge that journalists of all marginalized communities kind of face when we report on our communities, is the fact that, the stories we write at the end of the day are also about us. When I write about, anti-LGBTQ plus animus from the federal government, that impacts me every day. And so I think from queer and trans journalists, I've seen almost a greater commitment to the work that we do, in that, especially as we see, frankly, our journalistic colleagues kind of fall down on this, we say like, okay, well, now's our time. This is what we were kind of made for. This is why we do this work when moments like this happen. And then I think, the flip side of that is, that frustration at our colleagues who, we know can do better. It's definitely a rock and a hard place that, it's tough on a personal level have to deal with this. It's tough to have to compartmentalize to do this work. That being said, I think a lot of people's own personal experiences as queer people experiencing this has elevated their journalism in a lot of really powerful ways. But then, as an industry, I think journalists, queer and trans journalists, are really grappling with the fact that so many of our journalistic colleagues are doing harm with the work that they do.
Can you elaborate on that?
There are obviously certain legacy institutions who have really made a name for themselves lately for their just significant anti-trans coverage that frankly violates what feels like every journalistic norm, every ethical norm in this industry that other journalists abide by. And there have been significant efforts for, at the Trans Journalist Association, but just like among caring journalists to, for newsrooms to address this with varying successes. And I think we as an institution, the press really need to grapple with how we're treating this issue. Because for up until very recently, it was pretty poor.
And this is why diversity in the media and really across the board is so important. Are you finding that there are more and more queer people and trans people working as journalists in major media outlets?
I would say yes and no. I think, a lot more journalists are comfortable being openly trans and openly queer. But frankly, at the Trans Journalists Association, I am the board secretary of the Trans Journalists Association as well. And, so many of our members struggle with getting jobs, struggle with being taken seriously in newsrooms that see us as activists and advocates and not journalists. And so, I think it's twofold. I think in the newsrooms that care about affirming and uplifting their queer and trans colleagues, certainly I've seen, newsrooms or journalists gravitate to those newsrooms, thinking, like the 19th being a great example. But I think, there are those whisper networks certainly that exist where we know that queer and trans people either aren't going to be like welcomed or affirmed in the newsroom, or the newsrooms have taken a position that they are going to cover these issues from an antagonistic perspective that makes it hard for them to retain queer and trans folks. Like, I certainly wouldn't want to work in a newsroom that has written like that fear-mongering coverage about trans people. I wouldn't want to walk in that door, certainly.
Adam Rhodes is a first-generation Cuban-American journalist whose work primarily focuses on queer people and the criminal legal system. Adam is also a training director at Investigative Reporters and Editors. You can find Adam's piece for The Appeal, Trump's War on Trans People, a Legal Survival Guide, on our website, kalw.org, click news, and then your call. Adam, thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. Thanks to Kevin Vance for engineering our show today. Thanks to Andrew Stelzer for producing today's show. And thank you so much for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.